Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
Today, my favorite presenter of all 1,000 presenters, I'm going to be biased, yes, probably because he's my biggest teacher as well, Paul Linden. Paul Linden is a 6-degree black belt in Aikido. That's a big deal. He's trained in Feldenkrais method, karate black belt as well, but he's mostly known for his work in embodied peace building and trauma education. So he's been doing work with people who have been abused and other kinds of trauma for probably, I think, 40 years, something like that, a long time. He's also got a particular quirky style. If you're offended by politically incorrect humor or awful puns, then this is your warning. Paul has a cheeky style that may be a bit familiar if you see me at work. And so is a little bit different from other stuff out there. Very original work, very practical. So Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's lovely to be here. Let me start with, as I usually do, with a safety contract. And also, if I speak too quickly for people who are not native English speakers, throw a shoe at me or something. The safety contract is nobody has to do anything. Take care of yourself, don't overdo it. If you need something and it's an emergency, ask for it. Somebody will figure out how to deal with it, but don't overdo it. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing or maybe worth underdoing, depending on what it is. But the other thing that I think of is if you can't have fun with pain and misery, why have them? So that's the watchword, sort of. Maybe it isn't that much fun, but we'll see. The thing that I always start with as a general thought is power without love is brutality. Love without power is ineffective. And we'll see what that means. Let's jump into some content. I'm going to try to get through a bunch of stuff quickly so we can actually do exercises. I want you to leave being able to use some of these tools. The first thing that I want to deal with is the language we use to describe our experience and trauma. Emotions are actions we do in the body. That has some pretty strange implications. We normally speak of emotions as thoughts, feelings. If somebody says, what are you feeling? You say, I'm feeling angry. I'm likely to say, no, you're not feeling angry. Angry is the name of what you're feeling. You get what that means? This. Is that anger? Probably. But is it the word anger or the action in the body that's angry? You know what I'm saying? A sandwich. A sandwich is a thing you can chew and eat, but the taste of it is not the sandwich. The feeling of anger is not the actual emotion. The emotion is the thing you do in your body. Most people don't notice that. So if you start to look for the thing you do in your body and speak about it that way, it produces a lot of changes. You're much more able to find what you're doing and change it in ways that make it more useful, make your responses more useful. If you say, I am doing this, but our language focuses us elsewhere. You stepped on my pet crocodile and that made me so mad. No, it didn't. You stepped on my pet turtle and I made myself so mad about that. See the difference. One focuses you on what he did or she did. The other focuses you on what you did. Is it necessary? Are you under the control of the other person? If I step on your pet turtle, will I make you mad? Will I automatically be able to control your body? Not if you have the tools and the resources not to. So many people use words to think and speak. In fact, most of us do, but the words are not the objects. Nonetheless, the words constrain how we think. If we use nouns to refer to emotions, we tend to think of them as objects. Is an emotion an object? An iPhone, this creature, is an object, right? But is an emotion an object? Anger, the word anger is a noun. So is an emotion an object or a process? Most people don't think about language that way. I have the dubious honor, I guess, of being an ex-philosophy major, maybe not so ex. And I think about language a lot, not what I say, but how I say. And one time years ago, I was walking by a pond in the spring. I saw the wind blowing the pollen off the trees onto the surface of the pond. And everything, the pond was rippling in the breeze. And I found myself saying, the winding is blowing the pollening onto the ponding. You get it? There was no object there, it's all process. But it was nouns that I said, the wind is blowing. Blowing is a gerund. The wind noun is blowing the pollen noun onto the pond. But the wind and the pollen and the ponds and the trees are all processes. And so was I, for that matter. So I've paid attention for a long time to what happens when we nounify things. If you think of it in terms of nouns, you will tend to try to do something. If I have, what do I have here? I have this. Can I let go of that? Yes. If I open my fingers, I release it. And you release a trauma. The metaphor is, yes, we can. But in the actual fact, can you release a trauma if it's a process? I don't think so. What are you grasping and what are you releasing? Metaphorically, yes, we've grasped it and we're holding on to it. But in actual fact, if an emotion is an action, you can't release an action. You replace it with another action, one that ideally will be more helpful and more effective and more efficient. See what I'm saying? So if you really are looking at what you're doing when you're talking, if somebody says, I'm so sad, I say, oh, really, where? They look at me like I'm a nutcase. In Columbus, of course, Ohio. I say, no, where in your body are you doing sadness? And they say, I'm not doing it, I'm feeling it. I think of feelings as the experience of the actions in your body. So if I'm doing this and I pay attention, I'll have a feeling that I experience. The experience is what this feels like to me. But if I'm not paying attention, I may not even notice that I'm doing anger or sadness or anything else. So the first job, I think, is to understand the language. You have to understand what you're trying to find.
Excuse me, Paul, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Is it at all possible for you to maybe move closer to your mic? Because people are saying that they can't hear you very well.
Well, I should have it on the let me see, I'll go to the references. I should have it on the headphone. I did. Let me see. Microphone. Oh, it's shifted back. Don't know why. There we go.
I should also say, for those who can't figure it out, I have Parkinson's. I've had Parkinson's for 18 years. That's why I shake. Does this give you a better yes. sound?
Thank you.
Thank you for interrupting. If anybody, that should do it. There. This better, guys? Okay, good. Thank you. I'd hate to not hear what I was saying. Okay, I was saying that language is where you have to start. That if you don't know that you're talking about a process, you're likely to use language that isn't quite accurate. I'm releasing a trauma. You can release a muscle, you can let it hang loose. But if trauma is a series of actions in the body that you've learned and experienced, you have to replace those actions. You can't just stop an action. If I stop my tremors, am I stopping my tremors? No, I'm creating a state of quietness. So you have to change it by replacing it, not simply by stopping it. Okay, that also, we talk about letting go of feelings. You can't let go of a feeling. You have to replace it with a different one. And that feeling is the action in your body. Okay. What I'd like to start with, everybody, you can do it standing or sitting. Raise one arm up to shoulder height. Move back a bit so you can see what I'm doing. Raise one arm up to shoulder height, put it down. Now raise it up halfway, put it down again. Raise it halfway again. Each time, raise it half again until it's getting so small that if I were in the same room with you, you would not be able to see it. Make it smaller, keep making it smaller. And then when it's down by your side and there's practically no visible movement, leave your arm down by your side and still feel that when you choose, there's a slight bit of sensation of raising something. Most people can feel that. Okay, when you found it, leave your arm down by your side, and whatever that slight feeling is, raise it up to shoulder height, but not the arm. Can you do that? What do you feel when you do that? Most people feel something, and I don't know what it is, I just call it something. Put it down again, and now raise the arm and the something at the same time up. Does that change the experience of the movement and the movement itself in any way? What do you feel? What do you do? Weird. What's weird about it? That's unfamiliar and weird. That's what's weird about it, I guess. Okay, I'll just assume that rather than reading all kinds of things and taking time, I'll just assume that everybody or somebody, most people I hope, are following along and experiencing something useful. I felt more power to raise the hand. Yes, when you put your body and your mind in this process, then you get more efficient and more perceptive movement. Notice I didn't say when you integrate your mind and your body, they can only be integrated. The French invent an instrument for disintegrating it. But other than that, you can't not have your mind and body integrated. That's again, another way of speaking about things that may not be helpful. Okay, that is what I define as intention or ki in Aikido. I use operational definitions. I don't want to give you more words. I want you to experience something that when you do this thing, the movement is smoother and it's more efficient and more useful in many ways. Okay, so what I'm talking about, when you're doing an emotion, you've got to dig down into the place where the intention to do the emotion leaks over from the mind to the muscles, whatever that might be. So if you can find that place where the intention is operative, then you can do deep change much more easily. I'm looking at my notes because I want to stick to a topic and go straight through it. Otherwise, I tend to teach like a plateful of spaghetti. And in a six-day seminar, that's fine. But we have only two or three days, I think, right now. Okay. I reframe body actions as hypotheses, and I test them. So the one that's very common in working with abuse survivors, if somebody asked you, to take it, you're feeling defensive. What posture would you take to show defensiveness? People do this, usually. Now, let me back up a bit and define the distress response. When anybody is threatened, harmed, challenged, faces any difficulty at all, our normal human response is to get smaller. We can get smaller by tightening, by collapsing, by running in fear, by getting angry, dissociating, smallifying the attention and the intention. So whatever we do, we tend to get smaller because we want to protect ourselves. Now, is that a protective process? If you would like to, if you don't want to, don't, please. If you would like to, think of something that makes you feel very helpless, and you're in danger and you may not be able to survive, but only a small problem. Don't make it a really large problem. What do you do in your body? If you'd like, you can stand up, please, and move around. Feel whether that feeling of threat and challenge and smallness does anything to your movement and your body. If you don't want to stand up, conduct an orchestra. and just see whether it feels different conducting the orchestra when you feel scared, angry, dissociated, any of that stuff. And now, let yourself hang loose. Let your throat and your tongue hang loose. Let your chest hang loose. Let your pelvic floor, my shoulders start to roll in. Yeah, okay, so when people feel uncomfortable and they feel threatened, they tighten or get small in some way. Does that, excuse me, does that enable you to move more or less well? Let me get some water. I believe I have some here. I brought some in. Okay, does it enable you, there it is, one second. Does it enable you to move more or less well? People generally find that when they tighten or collapse, do anything of that sort, they move less well, less perceptive, less balanced, less capable, less strong, less alert. So how does that qualify as a protective response? That's natural, all right, we all do it. But how does it qualify as a protective response? So we've just reframed this movement as a protective response, and we've converted it from a description of what we feel to an hypothesis about what we're doing. Turns out the hypothesis is disconfirmed. It's not a protective response, even though we all do it. So don't do it. But you can't simply not do it. You have to replace it with something better. But if I don't disconfirm it, if I leave it untouched, this is a protective response. Okay, now I'm protected. Then people will continue doing what works, what they believe works in their lives that they felt is protective. And you can't change something. You can't take a crutch till after you've taught somebody to walk. So I have to change what their understanding is in order to get permission to teach them to do crazy things. Is this a wide open posture? Is this more or less protected than this? Everybody feels that this is vulnerable, is it? Okay, how do I test that? I punch them in the stomach, lightly, of course. And when they do this, it turns out I can poke them anywhere I want. But when they do this, they're open and free and they can swat me and not allow me to touch them. So we've disconfirmed that hypothesis too. People, once they understand that they're less vulnerable, less penetrable when they're wide open, it feels all wrong. They don't like it. It feels wrong. But once they're convinced by experiencing it that it works that way, they're willing to learn how to use it. And then they can be safer by doing what really works instead of what doesn't work. Okay. See why I use the hypothesis crucial test process. I could spend a lot of time going slowly. I could teach people right away how to learn. I'm trying to teach people how to learn, not just, I don't want them to believe what I say. I want them to learn how to test things. And once they learn how to learn, then they can sort through a lot of stuff in their lives much more efficiently. Okay. Okay. Now, we're talking about trauma. Trauma does not have to be something unique in the sense that the smallifying, as I made up that word, which is neutral, I should shoot this thing. The smallifying does not have to be life-threatening and terrible. It can be a little bit. If somebody says, boo, that's a little bit disturbing, but it's not traumatizing. So it's the same process, whether you think of something really large or something not terribly large. Let me try something here. What happens when I throw this piece of paper at the screen, at the camera? What does anything change in your posture, your breathing, or what? most people will find that there is a bit of holding of the breath. It's totally safe. I couldn't reach you with it anyway. That's such a powerful reflex. Okay. I think I'd like to, let's see. Yeah, let's play the video of the riddles, please. I've got, I think, a 1 minute video or so. While we're getting it set up, what I'm trying to establish in people's experience is that power is not harsh, hurtful. Okay? Power must be joined with love in order to be effective. And I have to start by establishing a few things about the way the body works. Okay, there we are. I think there we go. This is the shoulder. May I?
Right.
Resist me. Dig in and resist. Okay. Hard, strong. Dig in. Push, push. There. Now raise your eyebrows. What happens? And why? Now, same thing. Say fish live in the water.
Fish live in the water.
Camels live in the ocean.
Camels live in the ocean.
What happens? For some reason, the sound is not the same.
Say something friendly to me.
It's very interesting.
It might be worth playing it from Julie's side rather than the tech host. It looks like the tech host's got a Wi-Fi issue.
Sure, no problem. Give me a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Coming right up.
Shoulder, may I?
Okay.
This is a few clips out of a 4-hour Aikido training video that I just completed a few weeks ago. Shoulder, may I?
Right.
Resist me. Dig in and resist. Okay? Hard, strong. Dig in. Push, push. There. Now raise your eyebrows. What happens? And why? Now, same thing. Say fish live in the water.
Fish live in the water.
Camels live in the ocean.
Camels live in the ocean.
What happens? Say something friendly to me.
It's really interesting to train here.
Now call me an asshole.
You asshole.
See what I'm getting at? The body does not like lies. It does not like negativity. And the eyebrows, that's the fear startle response. When you invoke the fear startle response, even if it's just a minor piece of the physical action with no meaning in particular, the whole rest of the fear startle response fires off. So much of this is physical. Am I afraid of something when I raise my eyebrows? My body thinks so. I must be, or I wouldn't be raising my eyebrows. But if you try to deal with it with the fear that isn't there, it's going to be hard. If you deal with the physical act of the eyebrows, and if there is fear, and well, where are we going to go with that? I think I know, but maybe you should. I shouldn't tell you quite yet. Okay. A situation does not need to be threatening to evoke the trauma response. Now, trauma is not a noun. It's a series of behaviors in the body. We can talk a lot about that, but if you come back next week, I'll tell you more about the specifics. But what I'm trying to do is teach people how to notice those behaviors and change them. And powerlessness is the inability to control what happens to us and what controls around, what happens around us. Okay. So power is not necessarily bad. It's got a bad press in this country, but it depends what you do with it and what you mean to do with it. Okay, now, those three movement riddles, and there's a bunch more, they are meant to demonstrate to people that there are certain things which are not philosophy, but physiology. If you tell a lie, if you hate, it weakens you. I love to get my hands on some of these extremists and say, okay, look, you can be angry and hateful, or you can be strong, but you cannot be both. Which is it, guys? They'd probably just shoot me and be done with it, but it might be fun. See what I'm saying? I don't want to preach at people I want people through their own experience of their own bodies to realize that we are built differently than the hateful ones would believe. Okay. Now, where does this intersect with social injustice? When you are angry, fearful, you numb yourself, it's part of the package deal. Dissociation is a numbing. There are many ways of numbing yourself, but not feeling yourself is the core requirement, I think, for being able to hurt people. If you can feel yourself, you'll feel what you're doing to the other person. And I don't think you'll do it, unless it's crucial and you need to. Somebody tries to cut my throat on the street, I'll probably break some of his parts if I need to, if I have to. I'd prefer not, but you do what you have to. Sometimes you do need to hit. You never need to hate, and hate makes you weak. So if you do want to fight, if you have to fight, you have to be maximally effective. You have to feel kindness and respect and caring about your opponent. If you don't, you weaken yourself. And that's crazy, isn't it? You have to care about your enemies in order to fight and win. But I think I've established that physiologically. People have experienced it by the time I say strange things like that. I don't want them to believe it. I want them to test it and find out. So let's stand up, please. Let's go through a few. I've been doing Aikido for 50 years, 51 years now. And so I thought about this before I started today. It's 1 minute a year for me to convey what I've tried, what I've done. I've got to hurry. I don't have another 50 years. So first core piece, let your tongue, your throat, your belly, your chest, your pelvic floor, your legs, let everything hang loose. Just let your breathing go in and out. We could take some time for the breath, but I think the breath will take care of itself for the afternoon if we just let the whole core of the body relax around the breath. Now, not everybody will find this comfortable. Some people will find it very uncomfortable. And if I had time, I wish I could work with each one of you. And I do have time, but not today. Okay. So the second piece, can you think of something that makes you happy inside? What does that do physically? Most people experience a softening in the chest, this opening up of the body. Have you ever been a star or a light or a firefly's butt or anything that glows gently into the world around? What would happen if you took that relaxation and that happiness and let it glow outward in every direction from your skin outward? How does that feel? If you want to answer, that's okay. I'll try to read some of them as they flash by. Beautiful. Okay. Now there's two more, and these are a little harder. The fifth one I won't do. That's nice. Cry with happiness. That makes me want to cry. But the fifth one is, well, let's do the fourth one, and then we'll do the fifth one if we can. This one has to do with how you sit. Where there we go. Can I aim this down? I should be able to. And then I'd like to play the second video, the one that says stabilize, not the one, no, the riddles we've just played. And I don't remember quite what the title of the second one is. Oh yeah, it should be, okay, we'll see. Where are your hip joints? Where is your hip bone? Everybody, at least in America, calls this the hip bone. And it is, but the hip joint is down here. In German, it's Hüfte and Hüftgelenk. In English, as far as I know, we don't even have a common everyday name for the hip joint. Nobody knows where it is. It's over here where the fold is. Put your finger in your hip joints. Push your tailbone down to sitting. How does that feel? Does it feel different from usual? And now play the video, if you would, please.
Mm-hmm. Paul, there's one called anger and one called inside. Which one?
That's weird. Oh, I think it should be part of, no, play the inside. Play the anger one. Let's see if that's it. No, that's inside. Play the other one. Well, let's watch this one as long as it's on. What I'm talking about here is how you learn to feel a person. And I've developed ways in Aikido of doing that. It's not about doing the technique on him. It's about feeling him and feeling into his body. So I can see what his body is doing. It's not a technique. I call it a discussion. But I have to do the Aikido defense techniques in his body, not on his body. And it's a drill the way I'm doing it here. I'm not thinking about combat as such.
Back to the EQ. And how are you going to do it inside somebody?
How do you do it inside someone?
You ever eat spaghetti with a fork?
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
Good. Stick the fork in my guts and twirl my guts up. Yes. Mm-hmm. Feel the difference?
Nobody ever says that. I don't know that anybody else in IQ does it. I'm sure somebody must. But notice that he's not on me. He's in me. He's joining me to do the technique. That's where the stuff gets interesting. He's going into my joint structure, and that is the way I train to feel the body. Okay, let's play the other one as well, and we'll see if that's the one I meant. If not, you'll just have to come back next week. See what I'm trying to get at? I'm trying to show people concretely that what they feel about their trauma, what they think about their trauma, how they speak works in strange ways in their bodies.
And why is it useful to me for him to really want to hurt me?
So you can use that.
No. It because that's the normal human reaction. Try to hurt me. If I want to get over to that human reaction, hit me gently. We're partners. We're doing anything. Does that cause me to be angry and afraid?
No.
Then what good is it? I won't learn anything. Drink this blood and go back to Transylvania.
That isn't quite where I thought I had included a different one. It was late at night when I did these. But that shows, did it look angry? Did it look scared? Was there any smallifying or dissociating? The purpose in my sense of the practicing Aikido or any martial art really, I think is to be present, to feel your power and your love as one and join with the attacker. Now, this is a slightly different topic. I've had Parkinson's for 18 years. I can't win. It's going to get me someday. So I think I can't control the weather or the presidential election. I can't control lots of stuff. So I think the real sense of power that you develop in the martial art is to enable you to look at your fundamental human weakness and say, I'm weak. We're all in the same boat together. Let's play and have fun. See what I'm saying? Power is necessary for love. If you feel too weak and helpless, how can you afford to open up? Well, how can you afford not to open up? Because that's where you derive your power. Okay. But what I'm talking about is when people are scared, the natural response is numbing, dehumanize the other. He's not fully human. Kill him. But when you dehumanize the other, you're dehumanizing yourself. And then you can hurt people and not feel it, and not notice that you're feeling their pain, and it's a circle. It's a vicious circle. The more you don't feel people, the more you hurt them, the more you're hurting yourself without knowing it. So you have to be number and number And then you feel less and less and hurt more and more people. It's not a good way to live. It's an excellent way to die, maybe. No, it isn't. Okay. Now, the problem is that if you don't have a way of stabilizing the body, this is what I wanted to show. I guess that I made a mistake on which clip I sent. If you sit this way, this new way of sitting, you'll find when somebody pushes on you that it's far more stable. You'll have power without much effort. And if you work with it, you'll discover that it's not, is it physical or mental power? Yes. My favorite joke, what's the difference between a duck? The one leg is shorter than both of the other one. That's how I feel when anybody says, is it mental or physical? See, so I'm trying to give people the experience that power, rootedness, groundedness is only possible with love. And if you're not loving, you can't be powerful. But if you're not powerful, you can't be loving. It's the same thing. I could say, das ist ein Stuhl, sitzen Chairs, this is a chair. There are three languages. There's only one self, one me. So I could I could talk about the mind part of me. Or talk about the body part of me, but there's only one me. So if you find the level on which to create the most efficient change, then you've got something that will be quick and deep. Now, the problem is that if you go to somebody and you talk about your trauma, what are you recalling? You're recalling what you did and felt. And how will it make you feel? How will you make yourself feel? Do you feel good when you talk about how bad you felt? When you talk about trauma without being able to settle your body, you're practicing being traumatized. That's a strange idea, isn't it? So if you practice being traumatized, you're getting better and better at it, which is good, I guess, if you like being traumatized. No, I'm such a smartass. Edit that out or something. But if you can settle your body first, I call it an empowerment sandwich. When somebody comes to me, I first do centering, grounding, settling, and then we deal with the trauma, and then immediately follow with more grounding and centering. So you walk out not feeling taken over by the old emotions and feelings, but you walk out feeling your ability to break free of them. Crucial work is done in psychotherapy, but I think it helps to have the power to stabilize yourself in power and love first. Gee, I seem to have actually gotten through everything. Amazing. Okay. I do have some time for questions or disagreements or anything.
Hi, Paul. I'm going to bring up the Q&A here and see what people have voted. Sure. Someone said, can you show us a few examples of how to replace some typical responses to fear and collapsing?
Okay. Right. Now, that's why I don't have the video, because I showed that. But let me show you. Okay. Let me take this off. I imagine it's great exercise, tremoring, but I don't need it right now. What do you replace it with? That I have, I've been engaged in a simplification process for 20 or 30 years. The first attempt was a book called Reach Out. It's a free download, it's about 50 or 60 pages. I finally managed to get it down to 5 pages. And that's the thing called embodied peacemaking process. And it shows the first one is letting the body hang loose inside, then making yourself happy inside, then shining that feeling of relaxed happiness out into the world. Then this sitting, and the last one is walking. And when you, those are the five simplest things I found, quickest, most easily adaptable things. There's plenty more. Oh, let me see, what do I have? Okay, yeah, okay, I can use this, I guess. If I, here where the tremors go. When I get into the power and the flow, I feel much better. So you can, I would replace anything with always the same stuff. Go back into the body, find out what you're doing that isn't working, replace it by softening, opening, becoming more spacious inside, being heartfelt, being grounded. Now, there are a lot of ways of doing that. I've got probably hundreds of exercises in the other books. My first book on trauma recovery, about 440 pages. So I've finally gotten down to 5 pages. I think that's a pretty good percentage of time saving. But I always replace it with the same thing. The question is, what do I do with each individual to find the path that they need to safely break it down into small series of steps and lead them to the same result in the end?
Paul, someone's asking about the fear of the invisible threat of coronavirus, but I guess it's exactly the same thing, right? It's just fear is being done in the body, whatever the stimulus is.
Yes, exactly. Fear is not of anything. Well, of course it is grammatically. Yes! What did you do when I did that? Can I reach you? No, but we startle ourselves. And the problem is our language. If we said, how do we stop doing in our own bodies fear of something that we can't see? Same way you stop doing fear in any way. It's very simple, very easy, very difficult and complex.
And you normally do your sort of frying the word, don't you, around, for example?
Yes. Okay, that's a good one.
I'm wondering if we can join Corona one.
Okay, let's try that. If you don't like Corona, talk about, say, cancer, rape, politician, whatever. Whatever gets you appropriately upset. You don't want it to be too big, but if it's too small, it won't help. So find something that you can say one word about. Uncle, mother, embodiment. What do you do in your body? Some variety of the distress response. Let your throat hang loose. Let your arms hang loose. Let yourself settle. Now say the word again. Do you have the same response to it? This is getting into more personally, individually created work, because everybody's responses are the same, but what they respond to depends on the circumstances of their life. Thank you, Mark.
Paul, people are asking you again about this what power is, and I think this is so key to your work. And I think what's most radical in your work is it turns over people's normal view of power. That you, you know, you have to be sort of nice in some way, or you have to be powerless if you're a good person. And I see so many versions of that around money, around political power, around so many people thinking of those two things as opposites rather than side of the same coin.
Okay. Let me ask a question. If your child were hit by a car and you saw them lying on the street bleeding, you went, "Ooh, blood, I can't stand it," would you be able to help the kid? If your client comes in, I had this once, a client came in and described something that I had gone through exactly myself about 2 months before, and it was pretty painful. When it happened, when he described it, I was there for him, because that's not his job to deal with my pain. And I had to be there because he needed me. So you set aside the stuff, if you have the techniques and the resources, and you're just there for your person. That's power. And it's power based on love. If you didn't love me, you'd say, "Oh, fuck you, man. It happened to me too. Get over it. Suck it up." But, that's no way to treat anybody, not even yourself. So you see, to me, what is power? Power is the ability to do what you need to do in an open, balanced, loving body. Does that make sense to people? What we mostly think of is what I call brutality.
Paul, what I really love about your work is just how simple some of the techniques are, like the sort of relaxing the belly, for example. I can teach that to business people or policemen. Yeah. You know, I can teach that in a few seconds, maybe if necessary, but really quick stuff. I don't have to teach them some advanced yogi posture.
And it's very simple because I've broken it down to the physical. If you say, keep one point, extend key, that's true. But if I name it, do you know what I'm doing? If I say, extend your energy to the ends of the universe, what the hell does that mean and how do you do it? If I say how to do some of it, then you can practice it.
Yeah, I once heard a Californian teacher say that in a workshop of British coaches in London. And one coach just looked at her and said, how?
Yeah, right.
Same thing again, extend your energy to the four corners of the universe, something like this. And the teacher just went, but how? And it was sincere, like the coach really learned. And this operational language, I always say to my students, is going to ruin 90% of yoga and dance classes for them. But they love it. And once they get told this about the method rather than the metaphor or they go, wow, that just makes teaching so much clearer and cleaner.
And learning, it makes it. I applied these things because I couldn't learn the other way. There's another one of my students, somebody who's practiced with me, Tana Shaler, who did a workshop here, a very nice one I went to. And she commented to me once when I first started badgering her about her language, I'm sad to know you're not sad is the name of what you are. Where are you doing sad? It irritated her no end. Now she gets irritated when she's teaching and people can't speak precisely. It's very helpful, but it's very weird.
It takes a bit of training, doesn't it?
And I think it does.
About a year before they really get it and they go, oh, that's not an operational instruction, and they're able to translate things. And, you know, because people are still getting at something when they talk about energy.
Of course.
But it make that more clear, more doable for people is just a huge gift.
Yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't work, all these other methods. I am saying that by my understanding, they're not as precisely described as possible. And when it's described more precisely, I can do it too.
The other piece I want to underline about your work for people, if I may.
Sure.
Is this is that it's fundamentally more empowering than most of the teachers they'll see here, in that your work doesn't ask people to believe anything. You set up experiments and say, well, your answer to most things is let's see or let's try it, and that's just a quirk. I think that's fundamentally more empowering than the sort of great guru whoever telling people they should breathe this way or stand this way or whatever.
I often get people coming into my Aikido classes when we could do Aikido and touch each other, saying, I say, why are you breathing that way? My yoga teacher said it's the right way to breathe. Right way for what? And I don't know. Why, is it the right way to breathe when you're in Los Angeles, when you're underwater? What are you trying to breathe for? So I don't think you can say what the right way to do anything is unless you say right for what, for whom, in what circumstance. So right. I always ask, what are you trying to do? Does this work for you? Does it help you do what you're trying to achieve? I don't know much, but I know what questions to ask. What are you doing in your body right now?
That's the standard question, isn't it? How do you do that? What are you doing in your body? And do you want to do something different? If so, let's experiment. Let's try something else.
I often describe my Aikido dojo as a research and development dojo, which is anathema to many people. The sensei has to know how to do the techniques and do them right so you do them the right way too. I don't know squat, so I just muddle through and we all practice together and try to understand as best we can. Any input from anybody is welcome, because if they are wrong, or if we can show them they're wrong, then they'll learn. If they can show me I'm wrong, then I'll learn. It's cool.
And Paul, in the last 5 minutes here, what is your sort of, what's been your key insight in the 45, 50 years of research you've been doing? How would you really refine that down?
In what context, in what situation, about what? The key insight for me in my personal development, I finally understood that I have a right to be alive.
Wow.
But that's the result. And you can see I'm enthusiastic. I shake when I say it.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, I could. Without tears, you mean? That's okay. I'll take my cue from Mark, from whom I've learned a great deal. I worked this stuff out because I felt I was brought up to feel that I couldn't do anything and wasn't able to and wasn't and shouldn't. And when I started Aikido by accident, I found that everybody around me was vastly more talented than I was about the body and about movement. And I couldn't understand anything anybody ever said. I do remember my first Aikido class 51 years ago. We were doing Shionage, and everybody said, no, Paul, the other left foot. And so I still, when I'm teaching, say, that move that part. I reach my hand out so I know which is the right and which is the left. But I found that it was very easy for people who were talented to have no patience, because I wasn't, couldn't follow the directions, didn't understand what I was being shown. And at one point, I remember when I was a relatively new Aikidoist, I said, I know I'm supposed to go with you, not against you, but what do I go with? And I said, I don't know. Nobody ever said what to go with. So I picked something, I'll go with his movement or her movement. And I spent a few years trying to have no effect on the attacker, which meant I could read the trajectory perfectly. Then when I was teaching as a new teacher, I noticed when people were grabbed, they'd look at the attack and they'd lose balance toward the attack. So I thought, well, don't drop your head. It's heavy. Keep it up. So they would keep up their head and they'd still lose balance. I noticed they looked down with their eyes. Well, the eyes are obviously as heavy as the rest of the head. So I said, don't look down. And they start still lost balance. I thought, what are they doing? All of a sudden, I got it. They're thinking down. So I spent the next 4 or 5 years walking back and forth in an empty room, thinking in one direction, thinking in the other, seeing how it scoping out how it affected my body. And this is the intention again. If I think that way and try to walk straight ahead, I'll go this way. If you want to try something interesting, make a square in the air and pick one corner as the home square. And when you get to that corner, keep going in the same direction, but want to go in the other direction. What does that do to your movement? Most people feel it gets gummy and hard. That's the same as going down the street. You're driving in, past the stoplight. The light turns yellow. Do you put your foot on the gas or the brake? And it wavers back and forth. That's intention. Till you send your muscles a clear statement, put it on this. It'll try to do both. So that was my Rosetta Stone. And everything else I followed has been based on the idea that whatever I'm doing this process of intending it, or it wouldn't happen. I just had to figure out where my intention was and why I would do that. But I had to know the intention and be able to change it first. If you get okay, then you can you can go back and work on your issues. If you try to work on your issues first to get to be okay, that's a slow, hard process. No, it took me 50 years.
But what this personal insight, it seems like something shifted in you recently since I saw you last. Yeah. What was the key there?
What was the key? I realized through something that happened with somebody that I believed in my body that I was always wrong and not worth it. And when I got that and understood it, then I can let myself feel that there are people who care about me, like you.
I care about you very much, Paul. I love you. And I know many members of this community do too. And I think as we move towards close here, I want to say that this conference definitely wouldn't have happened without you. I think for two reasons. One, I'd be dead.
Definitely. Me too.
And two, you've really, you know, I train the work that I've trained the whole team in that's enabled us to be resilient and stay relatively sane, you know, primarily comes from you. So thank you on behalf of me and the team.
As I said, this is my 75th birthday. And so this was a vast birthday present for me to see that some of the seeds that I've planted, you have taken and modified without genetic modification, that's GMO stuff. But you and some of the other people have taken it and created things that I could not have understood or created. So you're not cloning me, you're becoming you. And I think that's wonderful. That's a birthday present that I wish everybody could experience.
Well, your own somatic woods, Doc Paul, dedicated to you. Much appreciated. We do need to wrap this up. So thank you, Sensei.
Yes, I agree. And if anybody has any way of getting me to the Facebook page or something where people hang out, I would love to go there. I just can't understand Facebook.
Maybe Julie can help you after that with the Facebook, to some questions on the Facebook page if people want to ask questions. We'll put your website. Paul's website's got lots of like free resources and good ebooks that are very cheap as well. And some resources of his are also in the bonuses of the package we're putting out at the moment as well for the whole library, if you want to support us and, you know, just digest this over time. It's I think a natural next step after the conference to spend your time working your way through that. What else there? So other practicalities, lots of other good stuff on. In terms of people coming up on this channel, Julie, anyone you want to shout out on the channel?
Well, the next session that's coming up is in the keynote channel, on the keynote stage. But the next thing happening in the Trauma and Social Change channel is at 8 p.m. And that's going to be Ruby Gibson with Somatic Archaeology and Transgenerational Trauma.
Great. And the 6 p.m. keynote is the mega panel, which Paul's also on, which is just going to be loads of fun and pretty wild. I've just invited all my favorite people, basically. It's a bit indulgent. And Reverend Angel is at midnight, who I know is popular. Tomorrow, all sorts of people like Sharon Salzberg, you know, very Jack Cornfield. As ever, the conference rolls on with a million cool things. Breakout rooms are available. Paul?
I would like to say that I have found that it's possible, if you actually see the person, to do a lot of work online. And so it's an ill virus that blows no good. But I've been creating ways of working online that I'm having tremendous fun with. So if you guys want to join me, come and play.
Okay, Paul, we'll finish with the final quote. So we're going to put a book together of quotes. Do you have one sentence top embodiment tip for the book?
Yes, keep breathing and don't die.
Paul, love you lots. Huge, this has given me a lift today on a slightly gray, tired day. So much appreciated, sir.
You too, very much.
Bye-bye.
And everybody else, please. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Paul. That was great. Lots of love for you in the chat. Lots of love for you in the chat. Where did you want to go? Did you want to go to one of the coffee breakout rooms?
I don't know. I gather there's a FaceTime place where people hang out. They can ask more questions and such. I'd like to go there if I could.
Okay, to the Facebook group.
No, it is the coffee break room. So there's a link in the chat, and I'll send it to you again now, Paul. Right. So. Oops, that's your website. That's not the coffee break room. But here it comes. And you're welcome to join Paul in the coffee break room.
And I've got an hour till the next session, I gather.
Still with Paul Linden, everybody. What an opportunity.
Okay
guys, thank you very much for your attendance. It's been lovely. Great to see you, Paul. I'm going to close the room now.
Thank you, Thea. I appreciate your help. And you too, Julie.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Where is that link?
And I've sent it to your Facebook poll as well.
Okay. There is the link.
You see the chat?
It's in the chat.
Oh, okay, in the chat. Let me get to the chat. There it is. I didn't open the chat. I was too busy chatting. Okay, good. Thank you very much.